Good afternoon. This meeting of the House Resources Committee will now come to order. It is now 1:03 p.m. Friday, March 27th, 2026. In Capitol Room 124, members present are Representative Klum, Representative Hall, Representative Mears, Representative Sadler, Co-Chair Representative Freer, and myself, Co-Chair Representative Dibert. Please let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please take this time to silence your cell phones for the duration of the meeting. Thank you very much. I would like to thank Cheryl Cole from Records and Renzo Moises from the Juno LIO for staffing the committee room today and keeping us going. Today we will be hearing first from House Bill 266, Big Game Hunting Permits, from the governor, and after we will have a presentation from UAF Professor Philip White, entitled Electrifying Alaska's Rail Belt, A Generation and Transmission History. First up is we have ADF&G Commissioner Doug Vincent Lang and staff to present House Bill 266. Commissioner Vincent Lang, welcome. Would you and your staff please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation on House Bill 266.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair. My name is Doug Vincent Lang, for the record, and I'm the Commissioner for the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. With me is Maggie Elliott, our legislative liaison. Thank you for the opportunity to present today on House Bill 266, a bill introduced by the governor that would allow the transfer of drawing hunt permits for big game. Before discussing the specifics of the bill, let me explain the framework for Alaska's drawing hunt lottery system. Most of Alaska's big game harvest occurs during general season or registration hunts. And big game includes species such as bear, bison, caribou, elk, deer, goat, moose, muskox, and sheep across many game management units across Alaska. However, in some hunts, supply was insufficient to meet demand, and a drawing permit system was developed. The history of Alaska's drawing permits date back to the early days of statehood, when hunters sought to secure access to limited game resources. Over time, the system evolved to include a lottery system for drawing permits, ensuring all hunters had an equal opportunity or chance at coveted hunting opportunities. Today, the lottery system maintains a balance between conservation and opportunity by randomly distributing the limited number of permits to lucky winners. The allocations for these hunts are made by the Board of Game based on residency. Each year, tens of thousands of hunters apply for Alaska's drawing permits. Just this month, results were posted for nearly 400,000 applications that were submitted during the last draw period, which runs from November 1st through December 15th. These hunters have been eagerly waiting to learn whether they'd be hunting moose in an area close to home, or finally have the chance to hunt bison in Delta Junction, goats in the Tustamina Glacier area, sheep in the Tok area, or bears on Kodiak. These permits offer a variety of hunting opportunities across Alaska. Some key features of the current system include permits are awarded through a random computerized draw. The number of permits issued are adjusted annually based on population surveys and abundance levels. Applicants can apply for the same hunt or multiple hunts more than once, up to 6 applications per species with some exceptions. A person may only receive 1 drawing permit per species per year. Applications are final and fees are non-refundable. The fee for bison and muskox is $10 and $5 for all other species. And permits are non-transferable, except in 2 limited cases, the death of the original permit holder or active duty military deployment. In summary, the lottery system has evolved to balance conservation goals with fair access to hunters. What does this bill do? Well, under current law, when a drawing permit isn't used, the hunting opportunity is lost. This bill creates a narrow, regulated process that allows the original recipient of a big game drawing permit to transfer the permit to another eligible hunter. The original permit holder may transfer it with or without monetary compensation. In other words, they can sell it if they so choose. We expect the market for these permits to set prices depending upon the hunt. For example, a high-value species like bison, muskox, or sheep in certain areas have less than a 1% chance of being drawn, so these permits may have significant value in a marketplace. The bill includes several safeguards built in. The new permit holder must meet all conditions, regulations, and limitations of the original permit holder, including residency and other conditions like obtaining a valid hunting license and locking tag, as well as guiding requirements for non-residents. A non-resident permit can only be transferred to a non-resident, and a resident permit can only be transferred to another resident. Also, transfers can only occur before the first day of the open season for the hunt and only for a specific hunt that was originally awarded. This ensures that a hunter who unsuccessfully hunts cannot then transfer their permit later. Consistent with existing law, a person may not hold more than one permit for the same species, regardless of whether it is obtained by the draw or by the transfer. Protect the state of Alaska. The bill specifies the state is not liable for any losses incurred by a person receiving a transferred permit, including if the hunt is closed or restricted for a conservation reason or any other reason. If you pay for and receive a transferred permit, the state is not responsible for any loss, financial or otherwise. The permit holder must notify the department before the transfer occurs, providing the recipient's name, hunting license number, and other identifying information. Upon notification, staff will reassign the permit to the new recipient in the system. The bill authorizes the Commissioner of Fish and Game to adopt regulations necessary to implement these provisions, including establishing a fee to cover administrative costs. While it's possible that an additional position may be needed in the future, depending upon the volume of the transfer, we do not anticipate any immediate or significant cost. If determined necessary later, a position could be requested through the budget process and funded by the Fish and Game Fund revenue generated from the fees. So what are the benefits? A draw application revenue for the last 3 years has averaged about $2.3 million annually. We anticipate the revenue drawing from permit applications to increase under this bill. Knowing that permits can be sold or transferred will likely encourage more hunters and some speculative non-hunters to apply. If plans change, hunters could transfer or sell their permits rather than lose that opportunity. The bill ensures that canceled hunts don't result in wasted opportunity. Those permits can be repurposed and put to use by someone else, maintaining access for hunters. Also, non-hunters could speculatively sell their permit to a willing hunter. I should point out that because more permits will be issued, the department will need to issue fewer permits during the draw, as we currently employ a non-use factor in the number of permits we issue. This bill presents an opportunity to increase revenue for wildlife management, encourage broader participation in the lottery, and provide more flexibility and access to drawing hunt permits. As mentioned earlier, some draw hunts for high-value species such as bison and sheep already have less than a 1% chance of being drawn. This bill creates another avenue for hunters to access these highly desirable permits. Currently, hunters must apply during the application period and be lucky enough to win a permit through the lottery or through the governor's permits auction and raffle program. Senate Bill 216 adds another option, and the ability to transfer a big game permit creates a new market for these permits. With that, thank you. I'm ready to ask any questions, or we could go through the sectional first if you'd like.
Sure. Looks like the sectional's doable. Ms. Elliott.
For the record, Maggie Elliott, Legislative Liaison with the Department of Fish and Game. I will now read the sectional analysis for House Bill 266. Section 1 amends the existing statute for permit transfer to require the recipient meet all legal requirements that applied to the initial permit holder at the time the permit was awarded, including residency and other applicable conditions. Section 2, consistent with the new provisions under this Act, Section 2 is a conforming amendment to remove the requirement that a person apply to the Department of Fish and Game for transfer or reissuance, which was formerly allowed only upon death of the original permit holder. And it adds language that a permit transfer under the new provisions in Section 4 must be made before the first day of the opening season for the hunt. Section 3, another conforming amendment to delete language that is now covered under Section 1. Section 4 adds new statutes allowing for the transfer and sale of drawing hunt permits after first notifying the department and providing the name and hunting license number of the recipient, along with any other identifying information required by the department. Consistent with existing law, the new provisions in Section 4 prohibit a person from holding more than one drawing permit for the same species, regardless of if it is obtained by the draw or a transfer. The Commissioner of Fish and Game is given authority to adopt regulations and set fees to offset administration costs for processing transfers or reissuances. This section also clarifies the new permit holder is subject to all conditions, regulations, and limitations of the original permit holder. And it provides that the state of Alaska is not liable for any loss incurred by a person who receives a permit transfer, including a hunt being closed or restricted by the department for conservation purposes. Section 5 shares an effective date of January 1st, 2027. This concludes the sectional for House Bill 266.
Thank you for that, Ms. Elliott, and thank you, Commissioner Vincent Lang, for your overview of the bill. It was a lot of information, and I'm sure there might be a few questions. Before we go to questions, I'd like the record to reflect that we've been joined by Representative Prox at 1:05 p.m. And I see Representative Sadler has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner, I didn't see it in the bill or hear it in the sectional, but I want to get it in the record. Is there any obligation upon either party of the transaction, the original issuer and the transferee, to disclose any fees or monetary compensation that they might have obtained from this? That might be a bit of data that might be useful in your management decisions.
Mr.
No,
Commissioner?
I do not think that there is a requirement to state the compensation that was received for the transfer of that permit.
Follow-up?
I don't know. I'll have to check whether or not the regulatory, the sectional that includes me to adopt regulations to implement this might allow me to do that.
I was going to ask if had been considered, yeah. And if not, why? But I think that might be, as you write the regs, that might be just more data, you know? That'd mm-hmm. be helpful. And if I have a follow-up on that.
Follow-up. Thank you.
And I'll get right out of the way. Are there any, I understand the benefits to the permittees, to the hunters. Are there any management benefits to this transferability?
Commissioner Vinsley?
Yeah, through the chair. We can manage with or without this. We're currently managing without this, but this will basically, as I said in my comments, this will increase probably the percentage of drawn permits that are actually used in the field. So the number of permits that we actually draw out of a random draw will need to go down now that we factor in a non-use factor in the number of permits we put into the draw.
But it's not going to hinder or help your ability to manage.
No, we will manage either way.
Good. Thank you.
Thank you for that, Rep. Sadler. Are there any other thoughts or questions for Commissioner? Representative Kalum.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm trying to figure this out. So if you have this would incentivize people to apply for the permit, whether they're going to use it or not. They could actually apply for it to sell it, correct? And there's no limitations on how much they could sell it for?
It would allow anybody, through the chair, it would allow anybody to put in for the drawing, mm-hmm. whether they intend to hunt or not hunt, and then sell that permit on the open market. I would imagine that some kind of market would develop for these, and then that person would receive compensation for that permit, and then the new person that got it would be able to hunt that hunt.
Can I follow up?
Yeah, follow up.
So do you see that, do you anticipate that this could shift towards big game guides because guides have more money to buy the permits, and do you think there would be some imbalance with people that have guided trips?
Commissioner?
Yeah, through the chair, I think that would, depending upon the hunt that you're talking about. For instance, if it's a moose hunt that has a lot of permits out there, it probably would be a less valuable permit and probably wouldn't go to a guide. But I think you'd possibly see an outcome where for a high-valued species like sheep in the Tok management area, mm-hmm. There would be an intention of trying to get somebody to buy that tag and then take somebody out that could afford to pay that tag fee to get out and go hunting.
Right. Yeah, so just follow up. I'm just working through my mind on those more valuable hunts. I feel like the marketplace would probably, the price would go pretty high because the big game guides would probably want all those. So I don't know if it's really helping hunters get more permits. But I do remember that you said, if it's a resident permit, it has to go to a resident, non to a non, correct? So maybe that competition would maybe be more leaned on the non-resident permits.
Yeah, through the chair, I would expect that a guide couldn't buy that resident permit and issue it to a non-resident. That would be illegal under this bill. However, it would probably be offered to another Alaskan that may want to employ a guide to go hunting, and that would be a very valuable permit to that person and the guide.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for that. Thank you for the great question. We have a question from Rep. Sadler, then Rep. Mears.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, to follow up on Representative Colomb's question, this is going to create a secondary market for draw permits, and the word that keeps popping up in my brain is Ticketmaster and scalping and a secondary market wherein some of the more valuable hunts. At what point does this bill create or not create a business model of a permit broker?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, I think that's probably exactly what would happen through the market. I think you would end up having a market develop for these tags, and you would basically monetize them through some kind of a marketplace setup. So, but I think that's what the intent of it is to get the permits that are unused out into the market to get them used so that people have an opportunity to get them that weren't lucky enough to draw one.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. I'm going to go to Representative Mears.
Thank you, through the chair, Representative Colomb, and I think Representative Sadler are going exactly where I'm at, and that concern is with access. And if there is a desire to have more people out on the hunts and utilizing them, having more opportunities for draw does that in a more equitable way than being able to purchase them. So it's a fundamental concern I have with this approach, is that it will reduce access for folks that are not in a position to buy them, and that folks that have a lot of money will just be able to get what they want. And I have concerns with that.
Okay. I'm going to go to Representative Freer.
Thank you, through Co-Chair Dibert. Thank you, Commissioner, for being here and for presenting the bill. I'm in the process of learning more about this. My husband goes in for the draw every year. He's never gotten one. And so I'm curious. I mean, I'm worried about the market that this could potentially create. I'm curious what the percentage is of resident versus non-resident purchases, I guess, or the to get a permit or to get the draw, and what the percentage is of resident versus non-resident who get the draw. It has to be 80% residents and 20% non-residents. Like, what is that structure right now?
Yeah, so through the chair, the Board of Game currently decides that structure. We just got done with the Kodiak board meeting, and they went through goats and bears with a lot of scrutiny. Depending upon the species, it can be either 20% or 10% or 90% that go to residents. And they look at that over a 10-year period of time, and then they instruct us to, when we're doing the drawing permits, to issue no more than 10% of the draw permits out to non-residents based on the criteria that they have. And then we issue those out as criteria during the draw permits. So, and then 10%, if it's less than 10, they won't get any. But if it's like 100 tags, 10 of those tags will go to non-residents, 90 will go to residents.
Okay. Follow up?
And they can change that any time based on, you know, their review.
Okay. Thank you. Just a follow up on that. So you said a resident would go to another resident, and a non-resident could only go to a non-resident, correct?
That's correct.
So is there any way, the Board of Game, are they the ones that make the decision on who that could go to? I mean, is there a place in this bill where we could say if a non-resident draw is unused, it could be transferred to only a resident, or does it have to be non-resident to non-resident?
That would be your call through the chair as legislature. But right now, that decision as to the allocation between residents and non-residents rests with the Board of Game.
Thank you.
And this bill specifies that once that draw permit is issued, it has to stay within that class.
Mm-hmm. All right. Representative Prox.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm actually interested in just the opposite. I think you said $2.3 million is raised through the drawing permits right now.
commissioner?
Yes, that's correct.
Right. And what is the total, I guess, total revenue raised through license sales percentage, resident percentage, non-resident, and then percentage of total budget? And if you don't have that, I'd like to get that.
So through the chair, that's a complex question, but non-residents pay a higher percentage. Revenues from non-residents are a higher percentage of the Division of Wildlife Conservation budget than residents. Mm-hmm. The fee structure is higher for non-residents. The license fees are higher for non-residents, and the application fees are higher. And there's often tag fees that are associated with hunting. So almost all of the revenue, I would say 80% of the revenue is coming from non-residents. And then the Pittman-Robertson Fund, which is basically a federal excise tax on hunting licenses, which is paid by across the nation, and we get a higher proportion based on our land area than our population base.
Okay.
Follow-up?
Yes, but I forgot what it was. Continue on, please.
Maybe, Commissioner, I don't know if this is possible to get that information to the committee.
We'll be glad to get that information to you.
If it is possible, it would be helpful in understanding the bill.
Oh.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Through the chair, all of the revenue generated is dedicated. It's a dedicated, not designated fund to fish and game management. Is that correct?
That's correct. The money that is raised by the draw permit goes into the Fish and Game Fund, which is a dedicated fund.
And follow up the licensing as well?
Yes.
Okay. All right. Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This leads me to kind of a philosophical question. I wasn't around or did not notice when hunting went from y'all come to being limited entry, essentially, with permits. Looking ahead, there's a lot of pressure on our fish populations, especially specific fisheries. Could you ever see, Commissioner, a day when we might have draw permits for certain fisheries?
Commissioner?
Through the chair, that's been discussed on a different bunch of different cases. For instance, on the Kena River, if we ever got back to a point of having not enough fish to open up an open period, could you have a draw permit for that? I haven't heard any solidification around that idea yet, but it has been discussed.
Okay. Good question. Yep. I guess I'll jump in the queue, and then I'll go to Representative Klum. For a non-resident who wins one of these permits or wins a lottery and sells it to somebody else, is there like a class for non-residents that have to come up here? What's the barriers to then you bought this ticket, then you come up, then what? Thank you, Commissioner.
So it depends upon the hunt. Again, you know, if it's a guide required hunt, they would have to hire a guide to go out and use that permit to go out hunting for that species. If it wasn't a guide required hunt, they'd have to figure out how they're going to get out in the field and use a transporter to get out and hunt. So pretty much how somebody who's lucky enough to draw one right now would have to go through those processes. The person that got awarded this would have to go through those processes. And it might be hard if that permit is transferred at the beginning of the season to find a guide, for instance, that's operating that area. They may already be fully occupied to get out into those hunt areas. So it might be challenging, but mm-hmm. If it was done early enough in the season, I suspect there would be willing guides to take that person out and willing transporters to help them get out into the field.
Thank you for that. Kind of gives me a 30,000 look at this bill.
Yeah.
Thank you for that. Representative Klum.
Thank you, Chair. Can you give me the range of the – what do people pay for a drawing permit when they apply? I assume it's a range on the species and if it's non-resident or resident.
I think I said that in my testimony. Here, let me look it up. I think it's $10.
For non-resident? Sorry.
It is $10 for bison and muskox and $5 for other species.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. and a bargain at 10 times the price. Commissioner, do other states have similar provisions for draw permits to be transferred or sold on a secondary market, or is this a pioneering effort from the state of Alaska?
Through the chair, we did some research. We didn't find many other states that have these programs in place. And, as a matter of fact, a couple states had them in place and repealed them and went back. Sure. Some states have some additional opportunities to transfer permits for non-fiscal reasons. For instance, you could transfer a permit to a disabled veteran, for instance, if you wanted to, or you could transfer your permit to somebody else in your family. But it wasn't – there's few states have it where it's monetarily compensated for.
Yeah, follow-up?
I'm not sure you said a couple. First of all, universe, how many states do or have ever allowed this, and how many have retreated?
That I'll have to get to that information, but I'm not aware of any states that have monetary compensation right now.
Okay.
But they do have transfer provisions that are a little bit more lenient than the state ones.
I'd be interested to know how many allow this. But
okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Any more thoughts? I guess we might need more time to look at the bill and think about this presentation. So I think we're good for now.
Well, through the chair, yep. Thank you for the opportunity to present. And if you have further questions, please get a hold of Maggie or myself, and we'll be glad to answer them for you.
Okay. Thank you, Commissioner Vincent Lang and Ms. Elliott, for presenting today. All right. We will go to our second presentation and final presentation of the day on electrifying Alaska's rail belt. Before we begin, Professor White, I know we have worked hard for this. Please come forward and join us at the table. I know we've worked hard for this presentation to happen over the past year, and you've been so forgiving over you've waited over long floor sessions, last-minute committee changes. So it's finally an honor to finally ask you to come forward and put yourself on record with your name and title and begin your presentation. Thank you so much for being here.
Absolutely. Well, thank you, Chair Dybert, and the committee for the opportunity to testify today. My name is Philip White. I am an associate professor of history at the University of Alaska, although I am testifying today on my personal behalf, and my comments do not reflect that of my employer or any of my colleagues. And do I have the ability to move the slides forward?
Yeah. And for the committee, Professor White would love to have questions throughout the presentation. So if you see a slide and want to ask a question, please let me know. And there is my hometown. Woo, on the front page.
Okay.
Elbow room right there, Second Street.
Yeah, perfect.
Memory's good, memory's bad.
Is that your car?
Oh, yeah. That is not my car, Representative.
Probably sometime in the late 40s or early 1950s.
Yes.
So thank you all for your willingness to sit through a little bit of history class. I promise the exam at the end will be easy. And at the very least, there's some beautiful photos as part of this slide deck. So my aim today is to not only offer a high-level overview of what we've built on the rail belt grid, but to offer some clear historical lessons for the challenges that we face today. And history does not tell us what to do, right? It just presents a useful guide about where we've been and why we got here. So as I mentioned, I'm an energy historian and historian of Alaska with a focus on infrastructure, electrification, and mobility. And so as a historian, one of the main questions is, where do you start this story? Right? When we think about the rail belt, where should we start? I'm going to offer a bit of a provocative answer there. I think we need to start in the year 1904. Okay? And in this year, in two distant cities, nearly 500 rail miles from each other, Alaskans were busy electrifying the far north. In the bustling port town of Seward, founded as the terminus of the Alaska Central Railroad, Seward Light and Power began constructing a 225-kilowatt hydroelectric generator on Lowell Creek that would power the young town. At the other end of the eventual 470-mile rail line, the Northern Commercial Company constructed a giant wood-fired steam plant that burned an astounding 8,500 cords of wood per year to provide Fairbanks with heat and electricity. This was a big deal for Fairbanks. This is why people actually wanted to come here, right? We had steam, heat, and electricity at a time when Circle and a bunch of these other mining settlements did not have those amenities. And in these two seemingly distant and disparate electric developments, largely forgotten in Alaska today, were catalyzed by the discovery of gold and formed the northern and southern terminus of what would become Alaska's most important electrical infrastructure, the rail belt grid. And so, the rail belt, as you all know, is our state's central power infrastructure that connects the Kenai Peninsula to interior Alaska and serves roughly 75% of the state's population. By line miles and geographical area, it's the largest non-contiguous power grid in North America. On par with the Trans-Alaska Pipeline System, the rail belt grid is the single largest machine in America's largest state. Although most Alaskans seldom think about the grid, it is a form of modern magic that allows inexpensive Bradley Lake hydropower to be sent at the speed of light from Ketchikan Bay to Delta Junction. And, you know, with the high cost of oil that we're seeing these days and the looming cooking like gas shortages, really forcing more people to think about their material reality, and namely where our heat and electricity come from. And so I hope this presentation foregrounds that the very materiality of that energy that is too often an afterthought. And so this research is based on a big technical paper that I wrote for ASEP last year. And as part of that, I went through and I tracked and analyzed every power plant that had ever been built on the rail belt, going back to 1904 to the present, and every line mile of transmission, so high voltage. And as part of that, I would argue that we can break down the history into these golden eras of rail belt generation and transmission, right? There's been certain moments where we've been able to build more than other moments. And collectively, since 1904, we've constructed 2.7 gigawatts of electrical generation and over 1,600 miles of high-voltage transmission. And each of these periods built on the period before it. So we get this kind of accretionary development pattern. And when I wrote this, one of the big questions was, you know, are we going to experience another kind of golden era right now? Right? It seemed like the stars were perhaps aligned on this. Over the past 5 years, we've had roughly 300 megawatts of wind proposed on the rail belt, Shovel Creek, Little Mount Susitna, Delta Junction. There are another 60 megawatts of solar proposed at Puppy Dog Lake and Nenana. We had a couple hundred megawatts of batteries proposed and maybe 50 miles of transmission lines. As a historian, we always, you know, when somebody asks a question about the present, we usually get nervous and say it's too soon to tell. We're not sure. But from where we're sitting today, I think it's very likely that we're going to build the Cook Inlet high voltage DC line. We've built a few of the big batteries. Hopefully GVA is going to bring on the next big battery. It's looking like Chugach is going to bring on 10 megawatts of solar. And GVA will hopefully bring on 36 megawatts of wind at Delta Junction, although that project will not get the tax credit. It's not going to get it in time. And maybe we will bring online some small hydro, right? Chugach is looking at that as part of the IRA tax credits. But its long lead times make this a challenging proposition. And so realistically, we're looking at maybe 50 megawatts of construction between now and 2030. A far cry from the 300, 400 megawatts maybe we're looking at. If GVA puts another LM6000 in North Pole, perhaps that could be 100 megawatts. But, you know, it's hard to argue. It would be hard to argue that this is shaping up to be another golden era for the rail belt. I fear increasingly we're just kind of muddling along. So as we look back over the growth of all of these different energy sources going all the way back to 1904, what we can see from this chart, this is the generation capacity, right? So this is the capacity of all the different power plants that we've built. And what we see here is really that the grid is a team sport, right? This is not simply about one power source or one asset. It's not just about one fuel or one technology. Alaskans have embraced all manner of fuels and technologies to meet our needs. We continue to rely on a diversity of molecules and electrons to power our economy and lifeways. And Alaskans, I think like many other folks, we love to debate different kinds of generation, right? Nuclear, wind, hydro, whatever it might be. But the reality is our history has been one of all of the above. And hybridity has really defined Alaska's landscape, right? We have embraced especially non-fuel resources like hydro because they are cheap. But at the same time, you need dispatchable generation in order to firm up the grid, especially our winter peaking grid. And so we can all, you know, we can look back in our history to at least the 1950s, if not earlier, to see how state leaders have been focused on reducing costs by implementing renewable energy sources, namely hydroelectric. And the moments in time when this ticks up is really relevant to where we're sitting right now, because it was in the 1970s with the energy crisis, and it was in 2008 to 2012 with the spike of oil prices around then. So we are in another one of these moments right now. And I would just kind of underscore here, throughout our history, we have sought energy security in fuel diversity. And I think one of the most intriguing recent announcements was the announcement from Red Dog Mine that they're going to install one of the state's largest solar arrays to displace the 40,000 gallons of diesel that they burn every day.
Dr. White, can I go back to that slide?
Of course.
I just want to share with the committee, growing up in Fairbanks, this is a really nice snapshot of our history. And I'm assuming before 1924, it was wood stove. But I remember when I was young, my favorite thing to do on the weekend with my family was to go to that coal bunker and drop the coal into the back of our truck and bring the coal back to our house and throw it in the burner. And we would also offset that. Another fun thing is going to get wood out at Rosie Creek, I believe it was. So using, which is crazy to think, both coal and wood to heat our home, even though it's still very expensive. It was a lot. And then I'm looking at, there's a thin line of nuclear, and there's a thin line of landfill gas there at the end, maybe.
Yeah.
And where is that in Fairbanks, or is that just Alaska?
Just Alaska.
Okay, Professor.
Yes. This is looking at electrical generation all throughout the rail belt. That thin line of nuclear is Fort Greeley because the grid was connected down to Delta Junction. And then the landfill gas is in Anchorage, connected to Jay Bear's project going back to about 2012, I believe.
Okay.
But I appreciate those personal stories of getting the coal. You know, we have, if you open up the Fairbanks Daily News Miner from 1919, people were celebrating when the first loads of coal came into town because it ended the wood famine. And I actually don't have wood on this graph because we were burning wood for electricity. I was not able to get firm data about how much wood, you know, throughout these years we burned, but it was a tremendous amount of wood. And in 1919, actually, it was before the railroad was completed, they laid the tracks over the frozen Nenana River to bring the trains into town to bring that coal in.
Amazing, yeah. I think it was the book, Two in the Far North, that mentioned the wood famine around Fairbanks. and I'm sure around Juneau as well, with mining and energy. Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Dr. White, Professor White, around about 2016-15, I see the sources of several gas and diesel and hydro all level out and are artificially even and predictable. But what happened that we get that kind of delineation that three or four sources of fuel are all right along under a cap?
Yeah, Representative Sadler, through the chair. Great question. To the best of my knowledge, what's happening there is we had a major disjuncture in the rail belt in terms of historically the three major utilities in South Central, Chugach, Matanuska, and Homer. You know, Chugach was the generation provider, and when that arrangement broke apart, each of those utilities went out and built their own generation, and that was an extraordinary building spree, about $1.5 billion. And so that really sucked up all the oxygen in the room, and then things stayed fairly steady for the next few years because we had just had this big generation boom. So that's my best guess about why the data is so flat for those periods.
Great. This is a great graph. I'm glad you put it together.
Yeah. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All right. So moving forward a little bit here, you know, this historical lesson, I think, is really we can build big things when the stars align. And the paramount example of this is the Alaska Railroad. So electricity followed the gold rush. Basically, anywhere there was a sufficient concentration of people and capital, an electric generator soon buzzed to life. Places like Dawson, Nome, Fairbanks, Seward, all electrified with their gold rushes. And from the very outset of the gold rushes, the question of transportation emerged as paramount, right? That was the big challenge to be solved. And I would argue that access and lack of access still define Alaska today. And so does anybody know, question for the class, why did we route the Alaska Railroad where we routed? Through the chair, if I may ask a question.
Is there a committee member who knows why we chose? It's the Parks Highway, I believe. Representative Sadler.
You know, if you don't ask, you don't get the extra credit. I would assume it's because it started off at the Matanuska coal fields and tried to pick up the interior where the Isabelle, and so it just zigzagged to where the energy is.
Professor?
Yes, through the chair. Absolutely.
Okay. So, gold star.
and as this map demonstrated, this is a brochure of the Alaska Railroad from the 1940s or 1950s. The coal fields are prominently located on here. You know, Fairbanks really served as the North Star for this infrastructure, but it was routed where it is because of where the coal was, and also because we convinced the federal government to build this infrastructure because of concerns about the trusts, the Alaska Syndicate, who had built the Copper River and Northwestern Railroad. And we might have gone through that route, through the Copper River Basin, except for the fact that that railroad was already there and the federal government did not want to give them any money to support that effort. But the Navy was really interested in Alaska's coal for the Pacific Fleet. So energy was not an afterthought in the design and construction of the Alaska Railroad. Congress approved the line to, quote unquote, unlock interior Alaska and accelerate coal mining. And then what we see with the arrival of the railroad is the railroad really promoted a thriving coal market, which in turn drove widespread electrification via steam turbines. So this is the first coal plant on the rail belt, built in Anchorage by the Alaska Engineering Commission, the same body that built the railroad. And, you know, more than any other single infrastructure, the Alaska Railroad transformed the energy history of Alaska and created an important template for the settlement and electrification of the region. And I think what this period of our history also demonstrates is how important federal spending is. Has been and remains for Alaska's power development. Mm.
And just for the record, you know, when I look at that graph last summer, a few of us, I think, here on the committee got to tour the Isabelle coal mine and got to go back in the back roads and see it on the mountainside. And it's quite a sight to be seen. When you go visit and see the coal, it's just right there. You can't miss it on the hillside. Yeah.
I am jealous. I'd love to make it back there one day. So this brings us, the railroad brought new economic opportunities. Specifically for Fairbanks, it was mining. It was gold mining. It was industrial gold mining. And the way they went about doing this is through electrification. So in the middle of town, the FE company built one of the largest power plants in the Circumpolar North at the time, 9.5 megawatts, and extended transmission lines out to all of the dredges. So all of the dredges in Fairbanks were essentially electrified dredges. And what's interesting about this, this created the basis for our modern grid. So if you look closely at that image of the old FE Company power plant, and you look just to the right, that was the FE Company's administrative building. This is the property of GVA. GVA now owns that building, and their headquarters is right next door. And this power plant was the first entity that sold GVA power when they became an electric co-op. GVA eventually bought the plant and operated it until Healy 1 came online in 1967. Eventually, that plant was actually sold and moved down to the lower 48, which is a wild story in and of itself, to Oregon. And so GVA is very is appropriately named as a utility because of the influence of this electrified mining in our town. And I would argue this also offers an intriguing model for us as we think about what might be called an electro state. As we look around the world today, we see some countries that are increasingly electrifying. And again, this, you know, you can do this with any source of electricity, but it offers really tangible benefits because, you know, electricity is a very powerful energy carrier. It its power comes from its efficiency, its ability to be moved instantaneously across long distances, and its ability to be generated from multiple sources.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Looking at the picture of the upper left hand, I think that must be approximately where the university is, maybe. But I see smoke and I see some snow on the ground. Any evidence or any historical record about air quality at this time when coal was a primary power source for the interior?
Professor White.
Through the chair, Representative Sadler. That is a great question. And, you know, from the vantage of this photo, the university is going to be back into the right on Trothieta. And, you know, I actually don't know what the facility is to the left where we can see the more, you know, the black smoke coming out. Things like ice fog had been a problem in Fairbanks for a long time and very well documented. So much so that in the 1960s, even, we see reports in federal power reports that people said, this is one reason why Fairbanks is electrifying so quickly, because it, if you can have those power sources outside of our airshed, you get the benefits of the energy without the pollution. GVA had something like 400 electrified homes. Think about just running, just heating on electricity year-round in the 1960s. But I don't have a great historical understanding of the kind of long durée of Fairbanks air pollution, but that'd be interesting to look at.
That's great.
Thanks. Yeah. Representative Prox.
Just a comment. The snow was black about 5 days after it snowed in many parts of town.
I believe it.
It was. Dr. White.
It helped the spring breakup come early.
Right. Right. It reminds me of the building of the pipeline when they sprayed coal dust on some of the mountain passes to accelerate the spring thaw. Yeah.
Please proceed.
Thank you. So this really brings us to this really frenetic period of defense electrification. Arguably no event more transformed Alaska than the Second World War. The U.S. government spent over $1 billion in 1945 dollars during World War II. That was more money than had been earned at every past resource rush in our history combined. More than furs, more than salmon, more than gold, more than copper. And the U.S. military constructed 39 major infrastructure projects, including like the majority of the airfields that we still have in the state, the first hydrocarbon pipeline systems in the far north, highways, not just the Alcan, but the Glen Highway, the Tok Cutoff, and new bases. And many of these new bases were basically self-contained cities. Ladd Airfield in Fairbanks, Fort Richardson in Anchorage. And it's only a slight exaggeration to say that the U.S. military built half of Alaska's foundational infrastructure during this period, not just World War II, but there was really a seamless transition into the Cold War because of the perceived threat of the Soviet Union. And along with this growth came tremendous electrification and energy use, fueled by the U.S. military.
Yeah, Representative Sadler.
Dr. White, I do see an error on that map. It has Fort Ray located in Sitka. Everyone knows that Fort Ray is in Juneau. It's right down the street, the SOB.
Thank you for, through the chair, Representative Sadler, thank you for pointing out that error. This report was published in 1945, so I'm not sure that we can, not sure about an avenue for amending that, but it's good to know.
Yeah, it's a really interesting map. Yeah, I haven't seen anything like this. I know in Fairbanks it was a big deal. We have strange army place, like military things around Fairbanks that were built during this time, and bunkers, and yeah, it's a really interesting part of our history in Fairbanks.
Absolutely. Yeah. Up on Skyline Ridge there.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Please proceed.
So as part of this, you know, our civilian populations did not have the electricity that we needed because of this growth. No place experienced faster growth than Anchorage. Between April 1950 and December 1951, Anchorage grew an astounding 51%. And so electricity was so much in demand that the city turned to a ship called the Sackett's Harbor. This was a T2 class tanker that broke up 800 miles off the off of Adak, and the stern was still floating. So they towed it all the way to Anchorage. They pulled it up on the beach, and they connect the generators. And the these oil-fired generators provided as much as 55% of the city's electrical needs until 1955, when a Kalutna Hydro came online. And for a brief period of time, it was the largest civilian generator in Anchorage. And what is, you know, this story is wild in and of itself. Like, you know, our history is so fascinating, you can't make this stuff up. But what's even more incredible is when the Sackett's Harbor was done in Anchorage, somebody then bought the vessel. They towed it to San Francisco. They rebuilt it into the world's largest wine tanker. And for the next decade of its life, it proceeded to transport California wine from San Francisco to New York, because they could save, you know, a few cents per bottle versus bottling it in San Francisco and sending it to New York City. Like I said, you can't make this stuff up. So just a brief overview of some of these, some of the largest military power projects during this period, specifically the ones on the rail belt. Plenty of other projects outside of the rail belt, whether it's the Dew Line or the White Alice sites. Tremendous amount of power needs from the military throughout Alaska. And just to move forward a little bit here, you know, the federal government was very interested in energy security for Alaska, mostly for the military, but also for the civilian population. And so the federal government was very involved in attempting to build Alaskan hydropower and build out our grids, right? They saw the power grid as a form of energy security. And what we see from this, this on the left is, I think, one of my favorite maps. And this comes from what was called the Morgan Report. And the Morgan Report looked at producing power from the Susitna River Basin. This is 1952. This is arguably the first map of a rail belt electric grid, where the federal government envisioned a 230 kV line connecting all the way from Fairbanks and maybe even north of Fairbanks if Rampart Hydro had been built, all the way down to Seward and Homer. And I find it to be a remarkable document for a number of reasons, not least of which is that we are still trying to build a 230 kV grid here, right? Large portions of our grid are still 138 kV, including the Alaska Intertie and parts of GVA's northern system. And so it was during this period the federal government, you know, it wasn't just studies they were investing in. The federal government helped build some of our most important hydropower facilities, specifically Aklutna Hydro. When it came online, it was the single largest generator in the state, and it was a tremendously important source of electricity at the time, and it still is today. People often cite Bradley Lake Hydropower as the cheapest energy, cheapest electricity on the grid. It's actually Aklutna, and it still remains Aklutna. I know the cost will go up a little bit with some of what's going on there, but historically it's been about 1 cent per kilowatt hour. So I think the, you know, the saying goes, nothing is better than old hydro. Some people have amended that to say nothing is better than medium-aged hydro, right, where you've paid it off, but maybe it's not so old. And what's really remarkable to me as a historian is that when Aklutna came online, and between about 1955 and 1961, renewable hydropower was supplying 50% of the rail belt grid's electricity. And this is remarkable to me, not least because in 2010, Governor Palin and the state set a goal of achieving 50% of our electricity from renewable sources, and we have not met that goal, right? So it is not historically unprecedented, though, that we would achieve such a goal.
Yeah, Representative Sadler.
I do have a question. Very proud of that. Aklutna is in my district, Dr. White. But as you speak about the best or least expensive hydropower or power as hydro, I had advocated on behalf of the Wetanasa-Sitna Dam earlier in my career here, and I hate to say that now it's become part of the historical record. How does history look at, I know how we look at Rampart and some of the other large, you know, the Yukon damming, but how does history characterize the Susitna-Wetana Dam proposals at this point? Do we wish we had done it? Do we think it was a good thing we avoided it? What's the buzz?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Sadler, I'm going to talk about that in just a moment. I think it's a really big subject. Mm-hmm. I probably will not speak to it as much as maybe you wish that I were would, but hopefully we can also talk after after the meeting. Yeah.
I was thinking the same thing. Yeah, my family's from Rampart, so I'm sure it was a hot topic in that area as well. Please proceed.
So it was also at this, or just to finish with this question of, you know, the state set this goal to have 50% renewable electricity by 2025. Obviously, we're a few months beyond that. And renewables are only generating about 30% of the state's electricity. So we got a little bit over halfway towards that goal, but we did not accomplish the 2010 goal. While Alaska has increased our renewable generation about 43% over the past decade, the nation as a whole saw an increase of 160%. But again, there's nothing unprecedented about this goal. We've actually been there in the 1950s. The other major thing that was occurring at this moment was the rise of the rural electric cooperative. You know, so often we focus just on generation sources, but it's really about the management of the grid, right? Who is in charge of generating, transmitting, supplying our electricity? And the Rural Electric Cooperative is a phenomenally important institution for Alaska. The bulk of our power comes from rural electric cooperatives, certainly on the rail belt where our four largest utilities, you know, other than the city of Seward, our rural electric cooperatives. And co-ops were this, they were a political compromise. In the 1930s, there were major fights about who would control the power infrastructure. Would it be for-profit utilities, or would it be publicly owned utilities like municipalities or maybe the Tennessee Valley Authority? And so the Rural Electric Cooperative was this middle ground. They are technically not for-profit private corporations. However, we often think about them as a form of public power, because if you pay your electricity bill, if your name is on your electricity bill, you can vote for the board of directors of the cooperative. And so they're a very interesting middle ground between these two different political economic systems. And here in Alaska, of course, we have our first major rural electric cooperative with the Matanuska Electric Association, incorporated in 1940. They're able to tap Aklutna Hydropower in 1942, which is really remarkable. So right at the beginning of World War II, they finished the transmission line to bring Aklutna Hydro to the farmers there in the valley. And what's really fascinating to me is it's during this period in the early 1950s that with the emergence of the Rail Belt co-ops, they are increasingly trying to work together to tap power sources. And the 1950s witnessed a formative but failed attempt to create a rail belt generation and transmission cooperative. In the mid-1950s, Chugach, Matanuska, Homer, and Kenai Electric Associations. Homer and Kenai used to be two separate electric associations that later merged. They formed the Central Alaska Power Association, or CAPA, for the purposes of developing, quote, cheap Kenai hydro. But friction over the venture quickly emerged and doomed the Rail Belt's first G&T cooperative. Although it accomplished tangible work by doing engineering studies on Cooper Lake Hydroelectric, applying for loans and filing preliminary permits with the Federal Power Commission, the G&T cooperative stumbled in the face of widespread resistance. And from the historical record, what I can find is that there was, of course, friction between Chugach Electric and the municipality of Anchorage. I think folks in Anchorage might know that story. In Homer, there was criticism that CAPA was not sufficiently transparent. It did not have proper accountability. And then in the Mat-Su, the main issue was switching away from coal, right? There was a lot of interest who did not want to see a transmission line built down to Cooper Lake and hydropower brought up because it would displace coal power. And so the outcome of this is in May 1957, the Chugach Board of Directors narrowly voted 4-3 after 2 hours of bitter debate to withdraw from the Central Alaska Power Association. As the largest member and driving force of CAPA, newspaper reports indicate that Chugach has, quote, chosen to go it alone, since it is the largest cooperative in the area and the only one financially capable of building the controversial Cooper Lake hydroelectric project, end quote. And so that's what happens. You know, originally the power line, as you drive along Turnagain Arm, that was called the CAPA line, based on this organization. Chugach ended up building it, but we did not have a unified G&T cooperative, and we still don't. And so I think there's an argument some of the infighting that we've seen amongst the rail belt cooperatives probably goes back to the 1950s, to this failed attempt in 1957. But the importance of building these transmission lines became very clear in 1962, after Cook Inlet gas and oil is discovered. We bring online the first natural gas generator at Bernice Lake, and so that power line that was built for Cooper Lake Hydro then begins transmitting gas power. And so I think one of the clear lessons is that when we build these transmission lines, they facilitate a diversity of generation, right? The transmission line doesn't, you know, there's no such thing as a green electron or a brown electron, right? Transmission lines are happy to have any electrons flow over them. And we can see that with other projects, right? Look at Beluga, the transmission lines built out to the Beluga project. They are going to soon see solar electrons that are flowing through those lines. Okay, so bringing us up to speed here. I would argue that we've been most successful when building right-sized facilities commensurate with Alaska's economy and population. And hopefully, Representative Sadler, I'll get to your very pertinent question here. I think Alaskans love to dream of mega projects. We have this mega project mentality. It's really interesting to think about where does this come from in our history. It probably goes back at least to the railroad, right? The Alaska Railroad was the only railroad in the country built, owned, and operated by the federal government. It was an extraordinary undertaking in its time in the 1920s and 1930s. And then, of course, World War II comes about, and it's not just building the Alcan. We also built a hydrocarbon pipeline system and airfield network along that. Arguably, the most expensive infrastructure project of the Second World War. Like, these are huge projects that were undertaken by the federal government. And so the upshot of this is by the 1950s, Alaskans are dreaming of these big projects. Chair Dybert, you referenced, I think, the keynote project there, which is Rampart Dam on the Yukon River. And in 1959, the U.S. Army Corps proposed damming the North America's mightiest river with a 470-foot dam. It would have created a lake the size of Lake Erie, drowned maybe about 7 interior Alaska villages, and it would have taken 20 years just to fill up the reservoir. It was so big. The project ultimately collapsed under its own weight. There was no viable market for the tremendous power output, and there was an uprising of conservationists and Athabascan peoples in Yukon Flats. And one fascinating story that I'm not sure many people know is there was a young school teacher in one of those towns in Fort Yukon. He also became mayor at that time. His keynote political project was fighting Rampart Dam. That was Don Young. That's how Don Young got his political career, was fighting Rampart Dam. Again, you can't make this up.
Go teachers. Dr. White, we have a question from Representative Prox.
Well, just comment. We really missed the boat on the Rampart Dam because we'd have the biggest soybean field in the world by now.
Through the chair, Rep. Prox, can you explain the soybean field?
Well, all the silt in the river would have filled up the Yukon River from Rampart to Fort Yukon.
Mm-hmm. I see. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Please proceed.
And so we see a series of these mega projects, right? It wasn't just Rampart. There's also the Yukon Taya project, where we tried to divert the Yukon River at the headwaters and create aluminum smelting in the 1950s. The Canadians weren't too happy about that one. Or Wood River, which would have dammed would have created a dam at Wood River. That's right.
Tanana River.
And even Susitna, I think, can be seen as part of this legacy, right? Susitna was a much smaller project. There was a lot of competition between the Army Corps and the Bureau of Reclamation over these projects. And I think what I would argue is that if you look at what we've built since 1904, we've been most successful at building small to medium-sized projects. I think the poster child of this is Bradley Lake. 120 megawatts, largest hydroelectric facility in the state, but it's not a gigawatt. It's not 3 gigawatts. And at the time when this was proposed, people said, this is wildly expensive. Cooking like gas is cheaper. Why are we doing this? This doesn't make economic sense. When we look back with the benefit of hindsight, this is one of the most intelligent things we've ever done with our oil dollars. I would argue Bradley Lake and Four Dam Pool are the second most intelligent thing we've done after the Permanent Fund. Because you basically took non-renewable oil wealth and you turned it into renewable electricity. And these facilities now provide invaluable and very inexpensive electricity, not only to the Rail Belt, but coastal communities throughout Alaska. And the small to medium-sized projects, they actually make quite a large difference. So when you add them up, Bradley Lake versus Four Dam Pool, collectively, they've saved an equivalent of us burning 2 billion gallons of diesel, right? If the alternative source of generation would have been diesel for those projects. And you can imagine, based on the cost of diesel at these various moments, you could come up with a dollar figure, but it's in the billions of dollars that we have saved through these projects. And these projects continue to save an additional 65 million gallons of diesel every single year that they're operating, that they are displacing. And so, coming up to the present, I think expanding Bradley Lake with the Battle Creek and Dixon diversions and the Cook Inlet Power Link project are smart ways to get more power out of highly valuable, right-sized projects. And in general, with these projects, they often seem really expensive up front. And that is because non-fuel projects like hydro are essentially the substitution of finance for fuel. rather than burning fuel on a yearly basis, you are capitalizing the expenditure up front, and then you're getting long-term dividends from that project. Okay, so couple more here. I know we're,
just on that last slide, Dr. White. I think Bradley Lake is at the very end, the other end of the rail belt. And I just wanted to mention that because not many Fairbanksons know or even understand this project. Like, I didn't really understand it until I got into my position here, just how important this energy producer is. So I just want to say I appreciate you kind of educating the folks in the interior about how we get our energy and our electrons across the whole grid. Because we don't know about it's a vast grid. So, yeah.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Diver. And you know, it wasn't just Bradley Lake, but it was also the Alaska Intertie that connected Anchorage and Fairbanks that we built. Originally, it was built for Susitna power, but Susitna doesn't happen, and Bradley Lake did. And so when we built that intertie, it enabled us to move these electrons up to Fairbanks. It links Fairbanks and Anchorage for the first time. And then even when we're not sending hydropower electrons up there, Fairbanks is able to benefit from all the gas-fired economy power that moved up that intertie, and it saved Fairbanksons tens of millions of dollars. In fact, I'm about to talk about what happens when you don't have that gas available, which is right now, and it's a pretty scary, scary situation.
Thanks for that overview.
Absolutely. And so if we look at big picture, you know, I would argue the gas shortage is the biggest energy challenge or biggest energy disjuncture the rail belt has ever faced. The discovery of methane gas reserves in Cook Inlet in the late 1950s and early 1960s proved an economic windfall for the young state and our largest city, Anchorage. Anchorage was one of the first cities in the entire country and indeed the entire world that was predominantly reliant on natural gas for both electricity and heating. Fun fact, the first piped natural gas in the state, though, was up in Utiavik in the late 1940s. And so, you know, gas turbines are a military technology. They come out of the aircraft industry. Oklahoma builds the first one in 1949. But Anchorage is building gas turbines in the 1960s, right? Anchorage was really a pioneer of this technology. And what we see is that Anchorage was really ahead of the curve, and there's a little doubt that Cook Inlet natural gas has been a tremendous asset for Anchorage and South Central. For decades, we had some of the cheapest gas in the entire nation. But as the gas wells run dry, our over-reliance on this asset is increasingly looking like a liability because so much of our generation is based on Cook Inlet gas. We can go back to the 1970s to see warnings that the Anchorage Bull was precariously reliant on Cook Inlet gas. We all remember the major warnings between 2009 and 2012, during which time the state permitted Hillcorp to gain a monopoly over the basin. And that brought us some time, but it came with some significant implications that we're dealing with today. And it's been almost exactly 4 years since Hillcorp announced that they might not be able to renew contracts, and I know you all have been looking at this issue very closely. But just stepping back here, big picture, because I hope that's the value of history here. If you look at the rail belt, we have derived the majority of our energy from four sources, okay? The coal fields at Healy and Matsu, the Cook Inlet gas, but also oil, hydropower from Aklutna and Bradley Lake, and then energy that we've been able to pull off of taps, mostly diesel and naphtha in North Pole. And out of all of these, Cook Inlet has provided the majority of our energy as a rail belt. And never before have we lost access to such a large pot of potential energy for generating electricity. Historically, we've gained access to large sources of power, but seldom lost them. The only other analog that I can think of in our history is when Cook Inlet gas power came online, all of Anchorage kind of shifted from coal over to gas. And the Mat-Su coal field shut down in 1968 when that happened. And that's the only other analogy that I can really think of. I mean, we're really heading into kind of unprecedented territory here. And I don't know the situation in South Central as well as I do the situation in the interior, but this is absolutely impacting the interior, because historically we got at least 50 megawatts of gas-fired generation economy power up the intertie. GVA has not been getting that power for the past year. And we can see, I think GVA is a little bit of a canary in the coal mine. So I just want to talk a little bit about what happened this winter in Fairbanks. We are facing an energy crisis, and I don't use those words lightly. You know, gas was cheaper and cleaner than our local pipeline era diesel units, so we really relied upon it. And Fairbanks has been effectively cut off from natural gas. And what we're witnessing is both aging generation, units, as well as growing loads. In the past year, GVA saw 7.7% load growth, really kind of unexpected. And as a result, this winter, we've really been maxing out our grid's assets. We had several close calls with having to initiate rolling blackouts. We almost had to initiate rolling blackouts due to a lack of generation. For weeks on end, including right now as we talk, GVA has to burn over 250,000 gallons of petroleum products every single day to keep the lights on. That is more than our local refineries can produce. So the only reason the lights didn't go out this winter is because GVA commissioned 2.9 million gallons of fuel storage at its North Pole power plant. And GVA just gave this update on Tuesday. I think this is going to be a major subject moving forward at the annual meeting. But on Tuesday, GVA said that it was 11 days from running out of fuel. And it's not just petroleum. GVA and other Fairbanks utilities have had major issues with moisture content in coal. And at one point during the weeks-long negative 40 weather, GVA's Healy plants reported only having 2 hours of coal left. And so the situation is so bad that GVA is now looking into acquiring additional fuel storage for the Chena 6 diesel generator. This is an emergency diesel generator that's located in Delta Junction. It used to be at the Fairbanks Municipal Plant, and they moved it out to the end of the line just as an emergency plant. They're now looking at spending who knows how much to build fuel tanks there because we're having to run this on a more regular basis. Mm-hmm. And so... And nothing I've said here is about costs. This is just about keeping the lights on. And so I think most people have not woken up to the severity of the energy shock that we are facing as a rail belt. So some solutions, hopefully.
Dr. White, just for the record, when is the meeting?
Yeah, GVA's annual meeting, I believe it is May 7th.
Okay.
But I should double check that and make sure that is accurate for the record.
And they can check GVA.
And they can check GVA's website, absolutely.
Website for that meeting, just for Fairbanksons to be involved and to listen. Thank you.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, I know the South Central utilities are dealing with this as well. It's not just a GVA issue, but we see different evidence of this energy shock coming from different places. And it's very acute right now in the interior after our winter.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And so if we look at our history, if we look at where we have been able to unlock the most value from the grid, it's when we've built transmission to connect our grids together and when we have efficiently moved that energy around. We'd call that power pooling. And I'm going to skip some of this that I had here in the interest of time, but, you know, the cheapest grid is the grid that you've already built. Getting the most value, the most efficiency out of the assets that you already have. You're going to look at something like the Alaska Intertie, right? Really important asset, especially for the interior, but also increasingly for Anchorage. When GVA is extra power, we're sending it south these days. And, you know, right now we're not getting regular natural gas generation sent up the intertie. So we're really just getting that Bradley power. It's not all year long. They're having to do a lot of construction on some of the transmission lines down on the Kenai Peninsula. There are times where that asset is less than 30% utilized. The state spent the money to pay for that asset. And yet, because of the structure of how our different utilities work together, don't work together, we are not utilizing those assets as much as we could. So there's certainly room for improvement there. And, you know, the Rail Belt likely has more power plants per capita than anywhere else in the United States. Part of this is because some of those power plants are for heat, right? Cogeneration units. You don't have the same type of heating needs in the lower 48. But it's remarkable the number of power plants that we have, and that does not always speak to efficiency. And what I will say is that I think the legislature and the regulatory commission have provided indispensable leadership to better unite the Rail Belt. We can look at the efforts of the Rail Belt Reliability Council, the RRC, or the Rail Belt Transmission Organization, the RTO, or the tight power pool that was mandated between Chugach and Matanuska by the Regulatory Commission of Alaska. In their July 31st, 2025 filing to the RCA, MEA and CEA said that the pool had thus far saved consumers $20 million, right? So when we work together, we save money and we help to solve these problems. One recent study, the E3 study, suggested that savings for the entire rail belt might be on the order of about $47 million per year of money saved. And think about it this way. Right now, Chugach is actually worried because they're having declining load, right? They're losing load. GVA is increasing load and doesn't have enough generation to deal with that. When you marry those two things together, there's a huge opportunity for power from South Central, if it's available, with gas-fired generation to be sent north, and for us to have a better collective solution. I just saw Representative Prax had his hand up.
Representative Prax.
Actually, I'll wait until you're done. Then
follow-up questions. Yeah. Okay. Please proceed.
And so it's really interesting to think about paths forward that might include GVA joining that tight power pool. Historically, we have tried to force all four major rail belt utilities to be on the same page, and that has not always worked. And so it's intriguing to think about, well, what if it was just three out of the four moving forward? And so maybe just to wrap up here, this is not a systemic solution in the same way transmission and power pooling is, but I do think it is a bright spot of growth, which is that individual Alaskans, we want to be part of the solution. If you give Alaskans the tools and technologies, they will deploy the energy sources that benefit them. And so this is a graph looking at rail belt solar capacity. And what we've seen is over the past decade, individual Alaskans and nonprofits have actually installed twice as much solar power as utilities. A lot of this goes back to net metering laws that ensure that if you produce solar power at your home, you are compensated for that. But I also think this history is important for us thinking about emerging technologies like plug-in or balcony solar. These are solar panels that you can just plug into a 120-volt outlet. We've seen these deployed in Germany in the aftermath of the invasion of Ukraine. There's now over 4 million of these systems in Germany. They tend to be installed at about a third of the cost as rooftop solar. So just trying to think holistically about, I really think we are entering a period of consequences and we are entering a period of energy shocks, and we need all the oars in the water, right? We need to work together on this from the ground up and the top down. So in conclusion, if you look at what's happening in the world right now, we are currently witnessing the largest energy disruption in world history with what's happening with the Strait of Hormuz. 20% of global crude supplies, 20% of global LNG cargoes cannot get through this strait. This is a significantly larger disruption than even the 1970s oil crisis. And the fallout of this supply and refining shock will likely last for years because of the disruption to refineries and the oil fields themselves. As you all know, while individual Alaskans now struggle to pay upwards of $5 a gallon for oil products, the state will get a little bit of an unexpected, maybe not windfall, that seems too generous of a term, but we have more money to spend than we expected that we would this year. And when we look at past oil shocks, namely in the 1970s and in 2008, these were the moments that the state redoubled its efforts to wean our electric utilities off of expensive petroleum. And these efforts historically have paid enormous dividends and keep more of our hard-earned dollars in the state. So what we do in this moment will echo for years and decades to come. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Dr. White. Lots of information, lots to think about energy here in Alaska. I have a question from Representative Prox.
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, you're giving a historical perspective, which is good, not to disparage that. But that's only based on what did happen, not alternatives that could have happened. And then one of my biggest gripes down here is that we now have, with an Excel program, we could model a whole bunch of these and be considering many alternatives in a relatively short period of time. Instead, we get a presentation on this, and then we get a presentation on that, and then we get a presentation on something else. And it takes years and years and years to come to a decision. And do you know whether there are people at the university that are working on that Excel spreadsheet, modeling all of this?
Dr. White.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, I would defer to my colleagues in the back of the room, the Alaska Center for Energy and Power, which do, you know, I am a historian by training. Certainly there's some quantitative analysis in here, but a lot of it is qualitative. It's looking at old newspaper articles and things like that. I think if you are looking for expertise in terms of modeling, I would look no further than the Alaska Center for Energy and Power.
Okay. Do they have time to
we
chat?
I think we do, because I have Representative Sadler next in the queue, and then me. So, so if you want to take a stab at this, please come forward and put your name, state your name for the record.
Thank you, Representative Dibert. I'm Jeremy Casper. I'm the director of the Alaska Center for Energy and Power at the University of Alaska Fairbanks. The short answer to your question, through the co-chair, Representative Prax, is that yes, this is being considered right now. I wish it were as simple as using Excel spreadsheets, but this is being worked on currently. The most recent report goes back to about 2024. In fact, there were two reports at the time. There was one analysis from the National Renewable Energy Lab looking at the proposed RPS standard at the time, Renewable Portfolio Standard. Mm-hmm. We had a parallel analysis looking at what would be the effect of that RPS on ratepayers. And so these are pretty intensive efforts to understand a pretty complex system. And so basically, our approach was to take a modeling system called Plexos, which is a production cost modeling, to look at various choices. And then during that modeling effort, we looked at basically scenarios. So we had one scenario we're looking at purely renewables. We had one scenario looking at a combination of baseload power. We had one combination looking at nuclear as part of that option. A large hydro project was considered part of that. And so that was a pretty long effort. It took about a year and a half. NREL, now National Laboratory of the Rockies, did a similar analysis. And now the utilities, as mandated by the, I can't remember what the bill number was, they are now in a IRP process, so an integrated resource process, and they're doing this as the four rail utilities. And so that process, I'm not sure how long that will take, but that's being organized and run by the Rail Belt Reliability Council. And so we should see results from that probably in the next year or so. And that is really to come up with an optimized set of decisions or set of information that they can use to make decisions about long-term planning for the Rail Belt.
Mm-hmm. And
follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up. Well, I talk about things that didn't happen. There were a bunch of things that didn't happen. The biggest one, I think, for Golden Valley is the relative fiasco of Healy 2. What was that, 20 years to bring that online, just all of the political interference and the this and the that and chasing after big projects and not doing something about the intertie as an alternative maybe to that. I don't know. And I don't know. Key word is I don't know. But you're right. We focus on great big projects, and we're not responding in the way it probably would have transpired had it been a for-profit operation, in that, oh, you need power next year? Well, we'll get right on it. And I often wonder if the Golden Valley system, when you consider everything, if we wouldn't be better off had we focused on a local system that was more resilient, easier to manage, and not dependent. We got is brittle right now. If somebody flies into the intertie, everybody's in a pickle. And yet we chased after, I don't know. You never close the debate, I guess. But we built a battery system that was all federal money or somebody else's money instead of looking at options that might have made it more valuable. And we need the arithmetic so we can compare as many options as we can in a reasonably short time and focus on that instead of, I don't know, I was on the Energy Committee for 4 years, and I just got tired of the conversation. I said, we're never going to solve this. Somebody else, go deal with it. I got floors to mop. You know? But we need to think about that is my bottom line. And the university is the right outfit to be doing it. And we should focus on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative, for your comments. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dr. Wood, I appreciate the history. It's important for us to know. And it's earned you the opportunity to hear a little bit of my commentary. They say you mentioned that the cheapest infrastructure is the infrastructure you have. And again, I'm very proud of the Eklutna Hydro Facility. They say the best time to build a dam is 20 years ago. The second best time is today. The legislature has considered and planned for hydro, specifically the Susitna-Wetana Dam. They've gone through a process, figured out that was the best bang for the buck, best situated. But there were complaints from people that it would take years, that the future would never arrive, it takes too long. Well, the future arrives. The thought was that it would kill a couple fish, or perhaps even that, God help us, that hydro is not alternative. And it's been frustrating because now, as you say, we're facing the biggest energy disruption, maybe the state's history. And so I guess I'm going to indulge in a little bit of what I told you. So I hope those who work so hard to deprive us of clean, cheap, sustainable hydropower through the Susitna-Wetana Dam are proud of themselves and glad of what they did because it's hurting all of Alaska. There, that's my angry rant for the day.
Okay.
Promise?
I'll follow up. Dan, you got me. I wouldn't swing at that if I were you.
Follow up.
I'll take up that argument. That's why we need the arithmetic. And something works if you get somebody else to pay for it. That's a key point on hydro. We've got, what is it, 300 years worth of coal sitting at Usabelli. And left to our own devices, we would probably have financed that and not relied and thought about depending, oh my God, I hope we can get Susitna, I hope we can get Susitna, I hope we can get Susitna, instead of being more independent minded. So, you know, I get your point, but it makes us focus on something instead of getting as much information as we can, and we need a quicker way to compare other things. I could be wrong. Rep. Sadler could be well, gosh, I can't say that word, but there's a possibility that he's right.
Well, thank you, Representative Prox. Is there any other comment?
If I may just respond, not to get into the middle of that, but just a couple high-level observations, perhaps, right? Representative Prax, I think, you know, GVA does need to take care of our own energy needs north of the range, right? We can see that that is true. And at the same time, I think our best energy future is interconnected with South Central, right? I envision a future where we are sending surplus electrons down that intertie when Anchorage needs it, right? That's how Alaska works, right? We need each other to come to each other's aid. The other thing I'd point out is historically we have found security in diversity, mm-hmm. and that can be done again, mm-hmm. right? I don't think there's any version of our energy future where we are only relying upon one source. The other thing that gives me great hope is what's called Wright's Law. Theodore Wright helped to manage the U.S.'s aircraft manufacturing during the Second World War. And what he observed during that process is every time you double production, you see a certain decline in costs. And so what we've realized is that there's certain technologies that are on these learning curves. Batteries, solar, wind, storage, certainly on these learning curves. And so I think we have an extraordinary opportunity as a rail belt right now to lean into some of these technologies that the more we deploy them, the cheaper they're going to get. And that for me is quite exciting.
And through the through
Mr.
the co-chair.
Jasper. Dr. Jasper?
Dr. Casper. Thank you.
Dr. Casper.
Responding to Representative Prax, yes, the cheapest way to get generation, new generation, is to spend other people's money. One of the main conclusions of our 2024 report was the best way to cut down on costs is to cut down on capital costs. And so whether that is through low-cost loans or tax breaks, you have to move quickly to take advantage of those federal incentives. So that is a key lesson. The other lesson from that report was Dr. White's conclusion about transmission. Transmission upgrades are key to any of these, the success of any of these projects. And then just one example from Alaska that we've looked at is the Kodiak system. Kodiak is a system that has been able to actually decrease their real cost for electricity over the past 30 years or so. They have done that through taking advantage of low-cost financing and grants to build out their system. And so they, through reduction of those capital costs, they have actually managed to lower their costs.
Yes, Representative Prox.
Just the other thought is to compare these wonderful grants and all of that to how many school roofs can you not repair because you're spending public money to do something else on electricity.
Okay. Thank you, Rep. Sadler. And I have a question before we end the presentation. I was thinking back to slide the gas shortage in the rail belt, and I believe that's kitchen lights, maybe. I'm not sure which platform, but you had mentioned that there's a pipeline that was built in the North Slope, the first one in the 50s or 60s, and then one in Oklahoma. And than up here. And you might not know the answer to this, but are there other Western states that have pipelines that are just challenging, like Alaska, like, you know, that go through mountain ranges, over rivers? Just a thought. Thanks.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the question, Representative Dibert. So, yeah, a couple of different things. The for the North Slope, you know, many Alaskans forget that.
Can you put your name on the record? There's two male speakers.
Yes.
So.
Dr. White here, University of Alaska. So for the North Slope pipeline up near Utqiagvik, many Alaskans forget that large quantities of oil and gas were first discovered by the U.S. Navy between 1944 and 1953 on the North Slope. And it was actually the U.S. Navy that discovered those gas reserves and built the pipeline and brought those online. Unfortunately, that was just for Navy facilities, and the local community did not get access to those gas supplies until the late 1960s. So the people of the North Slope had to fight for access to their local resources and were eventually able to get those in the late 1960s. The Oklahoma example I was talking about, Oklahoma is one of the pipeline crossroads of the United States. Cushing, Oklahoma is where a lot of our oil flows. I brought up the Oklahoma example. They were one of the first places to use a gas turbine to generate electricity from some of the gas coming out of those pipelines. When we look at pipelines throughout the lower 48, I do think there's other environments that prove quite challenging, especially when we get a little further north and we look at the Canadian example with the Trans Mountain pipeline. Pipelines have become very controversial in the United States recently. There's a lot of controversy happening right now over offshore pipelines on the coast of California. And so I think Alaska is definitely one of the most demanding environments on Earth for operating these pipelines, you know, not just the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, but also in the Cook Inlet. But we are not alone from having to deal with this, with these environmental challenges, especially as the pipeline systems age and we're seeing declining production from some of these fields.
Okay, thanks. Okay, any other thoughts? Okay. I think we fit the end of our questions and thoughts. I'll go ahead. Yeah, no more slides unless you have a closing statement, Dr. Casper or Dr. White. Okay. Okay.
I just want to thank Dr. Casper for being a good sport and letting me pull him up from the back of the room. This was not planned. And I would just say if folks, you know, again, all the material in the presentation is my opinion. It does not necessarily reflect that of my employer. But if folks have any questions, I'd be more than happy to talk Alaska energy history all day long. I have one of the best jobs on Earth, and I appreciate you all for your service and the hard decisions you all have to make.
Okay. Just like to say thank you.
Thank you for coming forward and getting in the hot seat. Thank you so much for both of you for being here. It gives us a great through 3,000 foot level and history of energy and our resources. So very, very much appreciative. That was worth the wait, Dr. White. Over a year, we've been waiting to have this committee hearing. So thank you. That completes the agenda for our House Resources Committee meeting today. Our next House Resources Committee meeting will be on Monday, March 30th at 1 p.m., where we will take up House Bill 321, Fish and Game Wildlife Refuge, from the Representative Andy Josephson. On Wednesday, we will hear a presentation on House Bill 381 from Nick Fulford from Gaffney Klein. So that'll be a good one. There will be no Friday meeting. The time is 2:45 p.m., and this hearing from the House Resources Committee is now adjourned.